Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
I'm all right.
Okay, let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. This is an episode of Worldwise. You are Paul Soni, a reporter in the Moscow bureau of the Wall Street Journal. And I guess ordinarily you write on things that are not Boston related, Paul, but I gathered that over the past week, since the identity of the suspects in the Boston bombing has become clear, you've been working that story, basically, right?
Yeah, so initially we weren't particularly involved in the Boston story, as you can imagine, because for the first few days there wasn't any indication, publicly at least, of who the primary suspects were. And then last Friday, we were all here in the office in the afternoon on a fairly lazy day, and it turned out that the brothers, the two primary suspects, had a connection to our region of the world. And so, yeah, since then we have been very involved in the story.
Now, are Russians very interested in this story?
Yeah, that's actually been quite. That's the Russian response in terms of the press coverage here has been kind of interesting. There hasn't really been, certainly not the level of press coverage that there is in the U.S. Not even remotely anything near that. And while I do think some people are interested, I definitely don't get the sense that this is a captivating story here the way it is in the U.S. Though obviously we have seen, Putin has responded publicly to it. We have seen it has landed on all of the major state TV channels and in some of the big newspapers. There have been interviews with the parents and a few sort of feature stories and sort of a blow-by-blow of what's been going on. But what's been kind of interesting is, for the most part, you see the Russian press quoting foreign press on the details of everything. So it's definitely not as big of a news story. I mean, as you can imagine, tends to be that, news stories are the biggest right in the region where they're located. So this is probably the biggest in Boston, second biggest elsewhere in the U.S., third biggest in Canada, however that goes.
What angle, in particular are the Russians who are interested in the story interested in? I mean, and how does that differ from kind of what Americans are interested in?
You have to remember here that the vast majority of the media is state controlled. The kind of coverage isn't not, while yes, it may in part reflect the interests of the Russian reader or Russian TV watcher, it's also reflecting to some degree, you have to think, what the state wants to be saying about this event. And that's definitely something that we've seen here. So initially, the reaction on the part of the Kremlin and on the part of the Russian government was to distance themselves from the Tsarnaevs. They did not want they did not want to be closely related to them. They initially said, look, these guys grew up in the U.S. You shouldn't be looking at Dagestan. You shouldn't be looking at Russia for where they were radicalized. You need to be looking in the U.S. And so that sort of defensive posture is really how it all kicked off here. And that's definitely been the line that has been held. Putin was asked about it on, let's see, late last week, so on Friday. And what he said was, look, we did give some information to the U.S. He sort of said any information that we would have given to the U.S. wouldn't have been, quote, operationally valuable or of operational value. Now, there's obviously been some debate about what operational value means. I guess that means that whatever the Russian authorities gave to the U.S. wasn't something that could have therefore provoked an operation immediately. So maybe it was lower level information. And then, Putin sort of and the Kremlin have added, well, and by the way, they didn't even really live here. So I think what you're seeing there is some sort of defensive posture of don't try to blame this on us. Don't think that just because these guys are not born and bred Americans and only came to the U.S. later that you can somehow say this is tied to the Caucasus or tied to Russia. So, but in a way,
But you
actually, what
know,
we've go ahead.
well, I was just gonna say, I would have guessed that there might have been a sense in which the Russian government wanted to kind of underscore the connection to Russia, just in the following sense, that I gather that for some time now, Russia, in perhaps in being defensive about how kind of brutally they suppressed the Chechen independence movement, I gather they've been trying to kind of sell to us the idea that, hey, look, you know, these guys are radical Muslims, although, of course, the independence movement was not originally that, but right. there is that kind of involvement now. And I gather that I thought the Russian government had been trying to convince us that, hey, we're all in this together. You know, for us, these independence movements are really just a manifestation of the radical Islam that also afflicts you, right? And yep. and so I would have suspected that in that sense, they might have wanted to underscore a type of connection to Russia, specifically a connection to radical Islam within those breakaway, would-be breakaway republics.
No, actually, that, you're right. You're very right, because okay. actually, in a way, what a lot of people said here when Putin came out with those comments last week was, look, he's trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, he's saying, don't try to pin this on us. This has no connection to our region. And then the other major thing that he said was, look, this justifies our campaigns in the Caucasus. You see what we're trying to do. So it's a sort of careful balance there. And those are the two main messages that are coming out of the Kremlin. One is, you know, look for these guys' radicalization in the U.S. We don't know anything of extreme nature that happened here that would suggest that they were radicalized here and that this has a tie to the Caucasus. But on the other hand, they're saying, look, you've been so critical of us in the Caucasus, and actually this attack is sort of a perfect example of why what we've been doing there needs to be done. So, you know, it's definitely this sense mm-hmm. that the Russian government is trying to have it both ways in their communications and the things that we've been seeing coming out of them. The one interesting thing there is that the Russian side has not actually come out and said, even admitted that they gave information to the Americans. They've not said anything about what information they gave, when they gave it, how many times they gave it. That has been a sort of black hole on this side of the world.
Okay. Now, I do want to pursue that a little bit, but first let me back up and ask you, as far as the connection to the Chechen and the kind of independence movements, which have right. become intertwined with radical Islam in both Chechnya and Dagestan. Right. What is your take on what seems to be the nature of the connection between particularly the older of the two brothers and that whole milieu?
Yeah, so actually this reminds me of one thing that Putin did say, and he expressed a lot of anger that people in the U.S. were referring to the Tsarnaevs as Chechen rebels or allied with the Chechen independence movement. And he said, look, I'm so sick of our Western partners and the Western media calling them rebels or calling them independence fighters. They're terrorists, mm-hmm. and we've been telling them that forever. And, you know, I can't believe that, I can't believe in the coverage of this that message has come across. So that's clearly Russia's stance on this. In terms of the history of the conflict, it's obviously very, very complicated. But initially, as you mentioned, after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a war in the 1990s in Chechnya that, you know, there are a lot of debates about this, but generally people say that sort of coalesced around a ethnic nationalism and separatism. Chechens who are their own ethnic group and speak their own language said, look, you know, neighboring Georgia is getting its own country. Abkhazia is fighting for its own country. Azerbaijan is getting its own country. We too want our own country. And Russia, because Chechnya was actually on the territory of the Russian Republic, you know, one of the 15 Soviet republics, because Chechnya was on the Russian territory, Russia said, no, you know, it's fine that we are going to, you know, have the former 14 republics become their own states, but you can't do that, because the minute that we allow Chechnya to go, then what happens if Tatarstan wants to go, and what happens if Ingushetia wants to go, and all of these other places that are, you know, part of the territory of the Russian Federation. So they saw Chechnya as a fight to maintain the contiguous nature of Russia as it was one of the 15 states in the Soviet Union, and they went to war against Chechnya in the 1990s. And as you said, so that there was that first war, and then the second war started in 1999 and went through the mid-2000s. And as you said, what happened was a lot of Salafi jihadist fighters came from the Middle East and elsewhere to sort of join their Chechen brethren and fight against the Kremlin, against what they saw as a colonizing force. And as that happened, a lot of the Chechen resistance changed in nature. It went from being a lot of people who agreed with a separatist nationalist idea to this more extremist, you could say, ideology of Islamic jihad. And then what happened was after the Kremlin subdued the insurgency in Chechnya more or less in the mid 2000s, in part by installing this hardline Chechen, sort of Kremlin-backed Chechen hardliner named Ramzan Kadyrov, the insurgency spilled over into neighboring Dagestan, and that really has become the focal point of the insurgency at the moment. And it's not controlled in the way, it's not controlled in the way Chechnya is right now, in part because Dagestan is incredibly multi-ethnic. It's it's known for being sort of the Babylon of Russia. It's the most ethnically diverse place in Russia. It has many different languages, many different ethnic groups, and that actually makes it, you can't do something like they have done, the Kremlin has done in Chechnya, where they've backed a sort of local, someone of the local ethnicity to sort of keep control. It's sort of a don't ask, don't tell us what you're doing there, but just make sure it's not our problem policy. It's harder to do that in Dagestan because of the different ethnic groups. If you were to, mm-hmm. to choose someone like that, then if the other people there who aren't from that ethnic group of the person you choose say, actually we're not okay with that. That's not okay. And so it's actually Dagestan is a lot more unstable in part for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And Dagestan is where the older brother actually visited, where his father actually was, even though they're ethnically Chechen.
This is something that's been really kind of missed in the press, is that actually they're only half Chechen.
The mother is from Dagestan. Is that right?
Yes, the mother is from Dagestan. She is an Avar, which is the main ethnic group. It's the largest ethnic group. It's hard to say it's the main one because I think it's still only something along the lines of a fifth of the population, but it's the largest ethnic group in Dagestan. The father is Chechen, but actually never really lived never lived for a really substantive period of time in Chechnya, nor did his children, in part because his parents were deported from Chechnya to Kyrgyzstan in the 1940s. I don't know if you know the history of that, but after, at the end of World War II, yeah. Stalin deported a large portion of the Chechen people to Central Asia because he sort of accused them of sympathizing with the Nazis.
Right. And even back then, some of the tension had to do with their separatist aspirations, I gather. So is it clear? I mean, in America, a big question is, when the older brother went over there, what kind of contact did he have with radical Islamists or jihadists? Because, it's an important question, really, in terms of the policy response to something like this. Mm-hmm. Whether you think of him as some guy who was, kind of getting orders ultimately from Al-Qaeda in some sense,
right.
Sent back with a mission, or this is classic homegrown terrorism, where basically he was just radicalized via the internet, he'd been living in America a while, These are two different kinds of problems.
Right.
Because for one thing, the things you do to fight Al-Qaeda abroad could actually inflame, some
Absolutely.
Muslims at home. So what is your – so a big question is, even though it seems fairly clear that he got quite a bit alienated and maybe radicalized before going over to Russia, there is some question about what kinds of contacts he may have had over there and whether he did come back with marching orders. Do we know anything about that yet?
Yeah, that is a very, it's a bit of a black hole. His time in Dagestan is, you know, I don't think anyone has really come out with a full picture of that. But we do know that he was, his father told us that he was going to the main Salafi mosque there on Khatrova Street in Makhachkala, which is the capital of Dagestan. But, you know, other than that, the parents have sort of portrayed his stay there as visiting relatives, hanging around, sleeping, not doing anything too extreme, you know, and I think the picture there still remains unclear. But what we do know is that before he left for Dagestan, which was in January of 2012, he had already undergone a significant move towards religious radicalism. And he was, you know, he had gone from being somewhat a-religious to really embracing religion and then sort of becoming an enforcer of what he saw as Islamic norms within his family, you know, telling his mother that she shouldn't be working at a spa and dealing with men, that she should be wearing hijab. And he, you know, they were sort of, his mother was also similarly undergoing a similar move towards a more conservative or radical, however you would interpret it, interpretation of Islam. So, so definitely there was evidence that he and his ideas were changing well before he arrived in Dagestan last year. And I think, as you said, look, I think it's impossible to ignore the role that the internet may have played in this. You know, if you look at, if you believe that the YouTube channel that is, you know, under the name Tamerlan Tsarnaev and the Vkontakte page, which is the Russian social networking page under Johar Tsarnaev, if you believe that they're accurate, and it does seem that they are, you know, there was information up there and videos that they were watching and links that they were sharing that certainly would have pointed in this direction. And that, you know, you could have been doing very well from Cambridge, Massachusetts. So, I mean, it is possible that it's maybe not one or the other, but certainly so far we haven't had any indication that an organized terrorist group has taken responsibility for this attack. And in fact, the main organized group in Dagestan, which is sort of wants to create an Islamist state called the Caucasus Emirate, a pan-Caucasus Islamist state, and they disavowed this attack and said they had nothing to do with it. Even though, if you look at Tamerlan Tsarnaev's YouTube clips, you can see that he was watching and interested in people who were tied to that movement. His entire YouTube screen name is actually made up of two past leaders of that movement. So, you know, is it the case that they were giving him orders, or just that he was, you know, these were people from who were sharing his ideas from that region of the world, and he was becoming interested in them? You know, I don't think that picture is clear yet. There's always a possibility, as I said, that it's not one or the other, that it's some combination of both.
Okay. Now, on this question of the information that the Russians gave to the U.S. government in advance by way of warning them about the older brother, you said that Putin is now almost downplaying the significance of the information, and I'm kind of imagining that could be a favor to Obama, right? I mean, a way to just take heat off Obama, you know, by way of suggesting that, look, this is not, you know, this is not something the FBI or CIA could have easily followed to arrive at well-grounded suspicions about Tamerlan. But I mean, who knows? I don't know. It may just be true that it was not operationally significant information, as Putin says. But one question I have is, do we have any idea how they got whatever information they had about him? It seems a little.
That is the biggest question right now.
It's kind of impressive. Yeah.
The biggest question right now is how did he come on their radar? How do you get information that is not operational in nature, a.k.a. maybe not talking to the most important terrorist in town, but is still worthy enough for you to send to the U.S.? I think the question of how Tamerlan Tsarnaev came on the radar of the government here is definitely one we're pursuing. It's one that is, you know, I think that's one of the biggest questions out there.
Yeah. You know, one.
Sorry, back on your. Sorry, back on your point of is the reason that they're saying the information was of no operational value is that Putin doing a favor to Obama. Putin has definitely for the last year not been in the business of doing any favors for Obama, as you've seen with the Magnitsky Act and the adoption ban and their response to the Magnitsky Act, the adoption ban, and all sorts of things that have been going on here. I would say that the reason if it's not just as you say, it may just be the case that the information was not operational, however you define that. But you could also imagine that would go along with this stance on the Kremlin's part of trying to distance themselves from this and say, look, it's not like they sat here in Russia and came up with this plot. It's not like we had information like that. And I think that is probably, if I had to intuit a reason there, I would be more in line with that side than some sort of partnership with the U.S.
Right. Now, when I threw that theory out there, I was just kind of wondering whether this event might have been the basis for the beginning of a rapprochement between Putin
Absolutely.
And Obama. Maybe they communicated over this and so on. But in any event, by way of that, why don't you tell me what, if any, effect this event seems to be having on U.S.-Russian relations?
Yeah, so I think the question you bring up is this a moment for Russia and the U.S. to have some sort of rapprochement? Is a good one. So far, we have not particularly seen any indications of that. The last time that Russia and the U.S. Were closest was, in fact, right after 9/11. As you remember, very famously, Bush looking into Putin's soul and that moment that they had together after 9/11. That is, they said, we can sort of put some of our differences aside and bond together against terrorism. And, that is, you'd probably have to say that over the last however many years, last two decades, that's probably the closest for that brief period of time. It's the closest that the U.S. and Russia have been. And since then, the relationship for a number of reasons has gradually fallen apart, probably first to do with the idea on the Bush administration's part to put up a missile defense field, which was very upsetting to Russia. The Bush administration's support of the color revolutions, again, very upsetting to Russia. And then that has just gone on and on and on with various things that the U.S. has done that Russia has not liked, whether that is the Magnitsky Act most recently, or there was certainly a sensibility on the Kremlin's part that the protests here in late 2011, that the U.S. was behind them or was funding them or was funding opposition, funding NGOs that were helping out the protesters. That was, Putin essentially came out and said that right after all of those protests happened in the streets in Moscow. So there, the relationship has broken down significantly. The reset that was supposed to happen, I don't think there are tons of indications that has been successful. But as you say, the one thing that the U.S. and Russia have always been able to agree on is terrorism, in the fight against terrorism. And so, if there is an opportunity for them to mend fences, this may be one of those opportunities. The problem that we see over here, if you looked at Putin's comments very carefully last week, he said something. He said as much. He said, "Look, I really think that we need to partner together more on terror and fighting terrorism. I hope this is an opportunity for us to do that." But at the same time, he was sort of sticking it to the West for saying, "Don't you dare call these people freedom fighters," And he even accused the West of funding independence movements, funding separatist movements in the Caucasus. I don't know any information about that. I've never heard of that actually being the case. Mm-hmm. There is such a hostile posture here already that even on an issue that you could think everyone would be able to agree with and that they would be able to build a partnership around, the water is pretty poisoned. So that's going to be really, really hard to get over. I think that remains to be seen. Yeah.
And I don't think it's clear that everyone in America would rally around that cause. I mean, there is the view that becoming identified with Russia's suppression of separatist movements is a big mistake, for the U.S. In the context of the war on terror. In other words, we don't want to be, because as you know, the Russian government can be pretty brutal in suppressing things. And we don't, and these, as it happens, are largely Muslims whose aspirations are being thwarted. Whether or not it was originally, an Islamic kind of movement, and there is the argument that homegrown terrorism is exactly the possibility of homegrown terrorism is exactly the reason we do not want to be thought of as supporting whatever Russia does to deal with a problem that they refer to as terrorism, although, of course, as the saying goes, one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. So there's hardly consensus, I think, in America about the wisdom of that. And in fact, right after 9/11, Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote a piece warning against exactly this. He said, there are governments all over the world that are going to now try to convince us that their problem with Muslims is our problem with Muslims, and that's the biggest mistake we could make, is to accept that argument.
Right. Well, I think I completely agree with you there. I think, but the one thing that you want to be, we want to be careful of, is how you characterize what's going on in the caucuses right now. And you know, there. I think if you were talking about Chechnya in the 1990s, you could have a very legitimate and interesting debate about nationalism and whether people should have the right to pursue their own nation if they see themselves as a people that is able to self-govern. You know, there was a very lively debate about that in the 1990s. What has gone on in the last 6 to 8 years here, particularly after the Second Chechen War, is a lot more what we would associate with as real as terrorism. When you're talking about the school siege in Beslan in 2004, when you're talking about the metro being bombed here in 2010, Domodedovo Airport in Moscow being bombed in 2011, many other terrorist attacks here, the Nordost storming, the theater siege that happened in Moscow. I mean, these are sort of really horrific, you might say textbook terrorist attacks. So is that a separatist war? Well, I don't know. It's really hard to say whether when one side is starting to act like that, this is separatist. I mean, are suicide bombers nationalist separatists? Maybe they are, but maybe they also have become terrorists. So it's like that line there is it's really fine. And I think, you know, on the one hand, I completely agree with you that you don't want to be, I think the U.S. needs to be very careful, as you said, about join in. We have our terrorists too. Let's all join together and fight. And there are extreme differences in a lot of these situations. But on the other hand, you don't want to deny. You don't want to say, well, a Boston Marathon bomb is a terrorist attack. But in Moscow, when you have a bomb on your metro, well, that's a separatist attack. Mm. That's kind of the exact thing that Putin was really lashing out on, saying, like, look, we have our citizens dying here too, and don't tell me that somehow those attacks are any more legitimate than the terrorist attacks that you're facing. Mm. And I think he does have a point there.
I mean, I guess I had in mind more, leave aside the question of whether it remains a nationalist thing. I just don't kind of want my security to depend on how exactly the Russian government chooses to deal with this problem. I mean, even when it is something that we would very much identify as terrorism, the Russian response can be not very subtle. I mean, the storming of that theater, for example, I guess they were, as I dimly recall this thing, I guess they had hopes. I think they thought they had some magic chemical that wouldn't kill everyone or something.
Yeah, Absolutely. That actually killed more people. Yeah, no, you're completely right. The suppression of extremist movements in the Caucasus has had all sorts of problems, human rights wise. It has not been, it's been an extremely, extremely grisly and violent situation there for a long time. So I completely take the point that not only does the U.S. really not necessarily want to be a cheerleader for that, you also have to consider, as you mentioned, how much the tactics of trying to subdue what are seen as extremist movements are actually perpetuating the problem. And there are a lot of people here, there are a lot of academics who have looked into this, and they argue that, the Caucasus have been, the North Caucasus in particular, have been an extremely violent place, especially Chechnya and Dagestan, for the last 20 years, and how much have those tactics actually convinced people to be more extreme, because they see no improvement, they're frustrated, and you can debate forever what motivations cause people to become suicide bombers or terrorists or whatever the case may be. And, mm-hmm. you know, there are a lot of people who would argue that these tactics that were used during the Chechen War, that were used in order to subdue Dagestan, extremist movements in Dagestan, actually perpetuate the problem. So, you know, it is a delicate situation, and just to say our terrorist is your terrorist, I completely agree with you, it's much more complicated than that.
And so that's interesting. So there is in Russia a kind of a left-right debate, you could almost say, that mirrors the left-right debate in America about whether a too heavy-handed response to terrorism doesn't create more terrorism?
No, the people I was referencing are probably mostly scholars, not necessarily Russian scholars, who are looking into whether the way that Russian forces have subdued the extremist actions or extremist fighters in the Caucasus have actually led to more extremist fighting. That I wouldn't say that is a raging debate here. I think the debate here is pretty non-existent and fairly clear, which is a very classic response. I don't know how you would explain it, extreme response to terrorism of, you know, let's just crush these people. I think that is definitely more characteristic of what you have seen coming out of the state organs here.
Okay. Let me just finally give you a chance to talk, if you want to, about a story that I think you had been pretty focused on before this happened, which is the Alexei Navalny story. Yeah. Is that the way you pronounce it?
Yep, Navalny. Yeah.
Tell us about that, because that's an important story, I think, in terms of the long term hoped for liberalization of Russian discourse and so on, and how authoritarian Russian will remain.
Yeah, so I think Alexei Navalny is probably the best known opposition activist here. He really shot to fame in late 2011 with these street protests that happened here after the parliamentary elections, and he was sort of leading the drive of calling the parliamentary elections fraudulent. And before that, he was an opposition blogger. He's an anti-corruption blogger. He will put things up on his blog and on his website that sort of out corrupt officials. And before that, he was very involved with the Liberal Party Yabloka for years before he sort of fell out with them over ideological differences tied mostly to whether or not they should ally with Russian nationalists. But what's going on with him right now is he is facing a trial in the city of Kirov, which is a couple hundred miles east of Moscow. And he has been accused of stealing sort of roughly $500,000 worth of timber from a state-owned company called Kirov Les. And what he has basically called as, look, this is just to try to get me to stop my political activities. And he's had a lot of other cases piled against him by the investigative committee here. So he's been charged in another case, and then there are I think three other open investigations against him, all of which have sort of piled up only since he became famous here as an opposition figure in late 2011. Really, I think this trial and the outcome of it will be a bit of a bellwether for how the Russian opposition can fare. But, you know, as I say that, I also kind of hesitate because he is probably not being treated the same, or, you know, there are people here who say he won't be treated the same as all of the rank and file opposition people who are also facing their own trials. That, you know, maybe there will be a hesitancy of throwing him in jail and making him into a political martyr, whereas, you know, his brother, who's also had charges filed against him, his friend, a lot of rank-and-file protesters who were involved in this May 6th protest last year after the presidential election, all of those people are facing their own trials, and everyone's saying, well, you know, there's no reason to not give them the harshest punishment possible. And, you know, we have indeed seen pretty harsh punishments doled out to them so far. So the question is, you know, will he be jailed or not at the end of this trial if he is indeed found guilty, as people suspect he will be?
Mm-hmm. Is it fairly clear that the charges are basically trumped up?
I mean, he would say that there's no way that he had that he did any of this, and he would point to the fact that you know, look, why are all of a sudden all of these charges coming against me? You know, these five different cases tied to various different things. You know, I mean, this case, the one that he's facing now, actually initially started in 2010, then was sort of closed, and then was revived last summer. So, you know, he is extremely, he's saying that this is a political vendetta. Putin has come out and said, you know, he was probably asked very directly about Navalny for the first time this week. It was a sort of telethon question and answer period with various citizens of Russia, which he does every year. And he was asked straight about Navalny. And he said, you know, he denied that there's any sort of political prisoners in Russia. He said that, you know, it's fine for somebody to fight against corruption, but, you know, someone who fights against corruption has to be clean himself in reference to Navalny. So, you know, the Kremlin sort of vehemently denies that these are politically motivated, and he, you know, and Navalny and anyone else in the opposition would say that that's absolutely not true. So so that is sort of that's the lay of the land. What's interesting is whether, you know, a lot of people have expect here that maybe they will give him a suspended sentence, which is to say that he would be found guilty, and then if he does anything else, sort of like a probationary sentence, if that keeps him under this situation, where if he does anything that is technically illegal, if he goes out and does an illegal protest or whatever the case may be, you can then be thrown in jail for that sentence that has been suspended. Or also, if he gets a suspended sentence, he thinks that that will allow them to prevent him from running for political office because he will have had a criminal conviction against him. So sort of the outcomes here, it's not just a guilty, not guilty, jail, not jail kind of thing. It could be interesting mm-hmm. how they decide to sentence him if they do in the end.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, thanks so much for taking the time, Paul, on a
Anytime.
Weekend especially. And mm-hmm. I do hope you'll come back and talk to us again. Yeah.
Absolutely. It was great
to
talk
care.
To you. Thanks for having me. Okay. Bye.
Same here. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.